Romantic Samba in Rio de Janeiro.
You're listening to WMUC FM College Park 90.5. We've got a new filter on the mic. It's a beautiful Thursday at 10 p.m. That means 10 p.m. EST every single Thursday. You know what that means. That means it is time for Moral Hazard. You'll have to excuse me for the first 5 minutes of this show. I'm a bit out of breath. I was running to the station. I had a chess game. Go a little over time. I did not win. I rushed and I ended up stalemating. It was a bad chess game, but I'm here. I'm here and that's all that matters. Moral Hazard on WMUC FM 90.5 College Park is here for you every single Thursday at 10 p.m. We are here always. We are always here. Welcome. Welcome to Moral Hazard. I am your host, Stephen Fung. As you may know, I've been the host of Moral Hazard for a bit over a year, maybe a year and 3-4 months, something like that. The new year is upon us here at Moral Hazard, and while your lifelong struggle continues, your struggle having to get up and go to work, go to school, go and do nothing, go and sit on your computer all day and play Fortnite, your struggle continues. And while it continues, the world keeps changing. The struggles of the world, they don't repeat, but they rhyme like history. And it keeps changing. The chords keep changing. The notes keep changing. It all is a bit similar, but it's all so different. But you cannot tackle these changes alone in this world. And that is why Moral Hazard is here. Moral Hazard brings you solace in the cold, gray landscape of the 21st century, the 21st century's American ecosystem of business, politics, news, economics, sometimes other things. Moral Hazard is here to be the guiding hand that tells you what to think, what to believe. Just kidding, but we might influence it if you listen, or, you know, you don't have to listen, just put it on in the background, turn down the volume to like about a half of what you normally listen to so I'm not destroying your eardrums. Let me be the passive voice in the background that tells you about what's happening, but you're not really paying attention because you're playing Fortnite, you're doing homework, you're facing existential dread, you're having woohoo time with your partner. Let's put me in the background. Let me talk. Let me talk about what's going on in business. What's going on in politics? What's going on in economics? Jerome Powell said what to who? That's what you need to know. That's what needs to be in the background during your romantic dinner date. You made pasta for your girl. You made pasta for your man. You made pasta for your envy, your partner. And I'm here in the background and I'm telling you what's going on. Will Smith slapped Chris Rock. What? That's what Moral Hazard's here for. And we're gonna tell you all about it. Moral Hazard is here, and we're with you every single Thursday night at 10 p.m. to talk to you about business news, about markets, about politics, economics, more. We try to stay away from politics. Because although power inherently influences everything else that Moral Hazard talks about, the FCC is kind of mean, and we don't really want to get on anyone's bad side. Also, not for nothing, but Tom McMillan, UMD Regents, is on the Epstein files, all right? He's in there. He's in the basically the board of directors of the school. I can't talk about. I can tell you that he was in the Epstein files. I can't tell you anything else because, you know, we don't really get into the politics here, okay? And that's one of our guiding principles here at Moral Hazard is that we actually don't talk about. We don't get to the heart of the issue. We can't get to the heart of the issue. We could talk about the periphery. We could talk about the floral arrangements, but we can't talk about what's for dinner. And that's what makes Moral Hazard beautiful, but in some ways evil. In some ways evil, because we can't tell you. I would love to tell you about, you know, what's going on at the heart of politics here in Washington, D.C., but, you know, I gotta look out for number one. Number one's me. I gotta look out for him. But, you know, we got a lot. Moral Hazard covers the past 7 days, give or take, in current events, broadly speaking. You know, obviously a focus on business, markets, politics, whatever, I already said that. We try to cover the last 7 days. If we didn't cover it the last 7 days, we'll try and cover it this 7 days. Yeah, that's our guiding principle. As long as the news isn't perishable that I'm spreading, I will try and get to it. Although we've had some hiccups where I get sidetracked. Getting sidetracked is a constant thing here at Moral Hazard. But you know, we try and work around it. But we've got a lot of stuff on the backlog for you guys. Past 2 weeks, we've missed a lot of important things. I want to try and get to them. If I don't, I'll get to them later or I'll give up on them. I've got a big running note stock of things that I want to spread to you, that I want to disseminate, you know, that I want to inseminate to you. this is not financial advice. You are free to listen. You are free to subscribe to every word that I say because, you know, it's who else is going to tell you about who said what to who issued bonds, who is having a liquidity event? You know, where else are you going to hear that? Bloomberg? You don't have a Bloomberg News subscription. What are you, Twitter? Just listen to me instead. And this is financial. It's not financial advice, but kind of is. You know, just not in like the SEC way. It's financial advice in the way that your drunk uncle gives you advice on Thanksgiving. It's essential. That's the kind of advice. You wouldn't hold me to it, but you sure will sit there and listen. You'll go, mm-hmm, that's right. Ain't a lie there. But you know, in character with what I, you know, with the show as it exists and has existed in the past year, I'm getting sidetracked already. Let's cut to the chase. Let's get right into the news because, you know, I've got so many things that I've neglected to tell you all about. We're not doing Alum of the Week. For the past few weeks, we've done Alum of the Week. We name a UMD alum, notable UMD alum. I believe the last one was Tom McMillan, UMD Board of Regents, former NBA basketball player, and featured on the Epstein files. But you know, we're going to skip that because we're going to get right to the meat of it. I would like to first take a brief moment to wish a very special someone happy birthday. Former Prince Andrew, or as now currently known as Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, because he has been stripped of his royal titles. It is Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, former Prince Andrew's 66th birthday. So everyone, please take the time to wish former royal Prince Andrew happy birthday. Today on February 19th, 2026, his 66th birthday, he was arrested, in the UK, on charges of misbehavior, apparently, related to his connections with Jeffrey Epstein. He had divulged state secrets, which appears to be a common trend. Mandelson. What is his name? Walter Mandelson. No. Peter Mandelson. Sorry. Peter Mandelson, ambassador of the UK to the US, another UK politician who was in the Epstein files also accused of divulging state secrets to Jeffrey Epstein. Although in Mandelson's case, it was in exchange for money. Or so the accusations are leveled. So yes, happy birthday, Prince Andrew. It's a shame that we find you on such an unfortunate day in jail for, you know, what you've done. You know, they arrested him. They picked him up. It's a crying shame. But yes, happy birthday, Prince Andrew. A lot has happened. A lot has happened, especially in tech and economics. I would like to get to the BLS report that was from last week. The Bureau of Labor Statistics released their monthly jobs report. So for the month of January, 130,000 jobs were added to the United States economy. That is a big bump that we had not seen in the previous few months. You know, typically sub six digits. In added jobs, I believe one of the more pitiful months, only 24,000 jobs were added. I believe that was September or maybe perhaps November. So there was a surprise with the BLS jobs report. 130,000 jobs were added. It's important to note that although the economy expanded and although we added more jobs, according to this BLS survey, once again, the United States economy continues to be pulled up, hoisted by the healthcare sector. 60% of the added jobs are attributable to the United States healthcare sector, with net losses in, you know, most white-collar jobs. The healthcare sector... An economy with jobs that are being propelled by the healthcare sector does not soothe concerns. And, you know, speaking to other professors, it seems like it doesn't soothe concerns on that end, on the more educated end of the spectrum either. When your growth in your economy is being spurred by healthcare in a country where healthcare spending already lags life expectancy compared to other G20 nations by, you know, magnitudes. I've referred to this graphic already, but if you look it up, the United States per capita healthcare spending is so far beyond the other G20 nations, yet our life expectancy is so far below what you would expect given the log trend that exists with those other nations. And that, you know, that's attributable to our insurance structure, our insurance scheme here at the United States. So, considering that the United States already lags its peers in results from healthcare spending, the idea that the economy is being propped up by growth in healthcare, it seems to me like a bit of a window repair economy. And, you know, that doesn't really ring any bells to people, but imagine, right? We know how GDP is calculated. It's the sum of final goods and services, right? Let's talk about the GDP in Baltimore, all right? The GDP in Baltimore is, let's say $1 billion, all right? Let's just say, you know, round it off, an even $1 billion, GDP in Baltimore. If I went and I started, a window repair business. Yeah? I own a window repair business. I own Moral Hazard's window repair shop. And I went around and I broke everyone's windows. I took rocks and I went to every townhouse in Baltimore and every office in Baltimore and I threw rocks through the windows and I broke all the windows. Well, guess what? I'm about to get $1 million of sales in my window repair business in my first year because everyone's got broken windows. They need their windows replaced. Bam, $1 million to the GDP. Added just like that by just breaking things, by just doing things wrong. You can collect a bunch of money from fixing it. So now think about the United States healthcare situation where you know, chronic disease, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and other ailments that are caused, lung cancer, ailments that are essentially caused by the United States, aided and abetted by the United States, through the roof. And then we're adding a bunch of jobs, hiring a bunch of nurses, hiring a bunch of doctors, hiring a bunch of, we're paying a bunch of pharmaceutical companies to research GLP-1 drugs. They're researching, you know, cancer treatment techniques. They're getting all these jobs to fix broken windows. You know what's the easiest way to avoid having to spend so much on healthcare? How about we start worrying about preventative measures? How about we start worrying about prophylactic measures to prevent people's health from deteriorating to the extent that they are in the United States? But they don't want to do that. Philip Morris has to sell their cigarettes. You know? I don't want to be RFK, but fast food companies have to pump their foods filled with additives. Right? Because it's gonna make that Big Mac taste 5% tastier. And then we get into the window repair economy, where you've got to go and you've got to get your triple bypass surgery. You've got to go and get your, you got to go and treat your lung cancer that was caused by cigarettes and tobacco and electronic vapes that were marketed to you because the government was asleep at the wheel. The FTC was asleep at the wheel. The ATF was asleep at the wheel. And now we're repairing windows. Nowhere near enough has been invested into preventative measures to ensure the health of the American people. Beyond just selling Band-Aids, selling GLP-1 medicine. Yeah, and that's why our health expectancy is so low. And we're doing a window repair comp. We spend so much money. Our health expectancy is so low. And it is quite a shame. And, you know, to move away from the societal implications of this, it makes not for a strong economy when your growth is being driven by window repair. This doesn't... The addition of healthcare jobs doesn't provide any weight to the argument that the economy is going strong. If people's health all got worse, if everyone started getting sick and dying, well, you'd have to hire more healthcare people. That doesn't mean that the economy is going strong. It just means that there's more people who are desperate to spend every last cent, who are willing to, you know, they have health insurance, but they have a $10,000, $20,000 copay, and they've got a cough up, and now we can afford more. Now Eli Lilly can afford to hire 10 new account executives. Is this the world we want to live in? Is this a world we want to live in where actual jobs that aren't just repairing windows, but exportable goods and services that can provide growth to the United States on the World Trade Forum. Those are being cast to the wayside. Meanwhile, we're just patching holes in our own house. That doesn't sound right. But yes, that being said, 130,000 jobs is nothing to sniff at. Those are people who are employed. Those are people who are able to go out, make a wage, not necessarily a livable one or anything like that, but they're able to make a wage and they are able to mitigate their expenses to some extent, possibly afford to live a little bit better than before. That's still good. But just like healthcare is repairing windows, so is the addition of healthcare jobs. Because that still doesn't mean growth in the United States economy. Beyond that, we're getting some numbers on loans. We're getting a lot of information on loans. We're getting a lot of information on bonds. That I would like to point out the predicament that we are in the United States bond market, the United States fixed income market. Thanks to the United States' bad behavior on the global forum, there is significantly reduced lender confidence in the United States. Netherlands and the EU are weighing unloading U.S. bonds. They're at least weighing reducing exposure to U.S. debt to U.S. debt issuance. China has ordered their banks to stop acquiring new U.S. bonds to reduce their U.S. bond portfolio exposure and to begin unloading U.S. bonds. China is beginning to unwind their position in the U.S. bond market. And while you may think that, this necessarily doesn't mean much, right, because the bonds have already been issued, the U.S. has already gotten the money off those bonds, and they can begin to issue more, the idea that yields through debt holders selling off their debt will increase and prices will decrease will make it very difficult for the United States to control their own bonds. It'll be very difficult for the Federal Reserve. It'll be very difficult to convince other bondholders to keep on holding. It signals to everyone else that you should also start selling. When Xi Jinping speaks, the world listens. And so that's already not a good look. And it makes it very difficult for debt issuance across the U.S. market. It's not just government bonds. When China and the Netherlands begin to unload U.S. bonds, that's also going to push yields up across more risky sectors, like, namely, private credit and corporate bonds. So at the same time that China, within the week that China signaled to its banks to begin offloading U.S. bonds, the tech industries began to issue bonds. Oracle and Alphabet, two of the largest players in the AI, shall I say, bubble. All right? I use bubble in the sense that they are a collective, but it also is a bubble. Oracle and Alphabet. Oracle is owned by Dinosaur Larry Ellison. Alphabet is owned by Epstein Files member and UMD alum Sergey Brin. And, who's the other owner? Whatever. I just shot that one out. Sergey Brin's in the Epstein Files. And a UMD alum. Shout out. UMD on top. Go Terps. Roll Terps. Yes. So Oracle and Alphabet, the parent company of Google, have also begun to issue bonds. And this is all to fund their cartoonish level of expenditure and exposure within data centers. Data centers are the data compute is the lifeblood to AI hyperscaling. And the current philosophy now is just to buy as many data centers as possible, buy as much compute as possible, and just start churning. Just, like clockwork. But here's the issue. If these corporations are beginning to issue bonds, to issue debt, at the same time that the U.S. government at large and the U.S. in general is having a issue with bond sales, it's going to tighten. Money is going to tighten because, let's think about it like this, right? Let's think about it like this. Let's say the U.S. issued $100 face value coupon bonds dated 3 years with a yield to maturity of 5% and a coupon rate of 5%. So the coupon would be every year, the face value of the bond, 5% of that gets paid out, right? To holders, to bond holders, right? So it's a $100 face value, 5% coupon every year, $5, $5, year one, $5, year two, $5, year three, $5 plus the face value, $105, all right? if these companies start to, if China and the Netherlands start to sell these bonds, well, they're going to have to ask for a lower price, right? At a yield to maturity of 5%, you would pay $100 for that bond. But let's say China was only able to sell that for $90. So it's $90, $5, $5. Let me do the math here. Sorry, let me do the math here. Let's just say I think that'd be around around an 8% yield to maturity. So now the yield to maturity is 8%. Now U.S. bonds go for 8%. You sell them for 8%. If that's what U.S. government bonds go for, because everyone's offloaded it, because now it's $90, they're now going for 8%. And that means that a corporation, instead of being able to issue their bonds at, say, 5% or 5% plus 1, so 6%, they'll have to go 8% plus 1 or 9%. Now they're paying 9% interest, and that's going to make things very expensive for them. It's going to make potentially debt issuance impossible or infeasible for these companies. It's going to make data center hyperscaling very, very difficult. And we have not seen the results of this, but it's the debt market's something that moves very slowly. And it'll be interesting to see in the future what happens when the globe begins to sell America. Only time will tell. Beyond that, I mentioned private credit. So a little bit of background. Meta, the company once known as Facebook, is a major AI player. They have spent billions and billions and billions of dollars. They're one of the highest spenders on AI, which is funny because they actually don't have any good models for released right now. They're actually doing really badly. Meta, in their journey to get data centers, they've entered private credit financing agreements with Blue Owl Capital in the billion of dollar figure. Blue Owl Capital is a private credit lender. It's a private equity company. I believe they do equity and credit. But Blue Owl's exposure to Meta's nonsense is through the roof. They have been signing checks for literally anything Mark Zuckerberg says. It's some real sketchy stuff. And, you know, markets, to some extent, we've talked about Blue Owl Capital before because they've had their moments. Their stock has taken a tumble in the past months. I believe when I last talked about Blue Owl Capital, they were at $14. I think it was like late January. They were at $14. That was down from, in August, they were at $19. This time last year, they were at $24. They are currently at less than half of that. Currently, Blue Owl Capital stock, ticker symbol OWL, is at $11.58. And the reason behind that is because their exposure to Meta's nonsense, to the AI data center financing bonanza is remarkably stupid. I get it's a private credit company. They don't have depositors, but you do have equity owners. You do have shareholders, and you do have lenders. To some extent, they are lending and then lending back out. There are still people you are beholden to. Just because you don't have depositors, right? No one can do a run on Blue Owl Capital, but you sure can still end up failing and losing your clients. And I think that's what we're seeing Blue Owl Capital is doing right now. This morning, Blue Owl Capital began to issue limits on redemptions of their private credit retail fund. So they're basically, investors can no longer withdraw. They're restricting withdrawals. The issue with this is that imagine you entered an agreement, let's say with your friend. Your friend says, I'm going to start a bakery. I need $100,000 from you. But, you know, whenever you want, you can get, like, you can, like, once a month, you can ask me, I'll give you $5,000 back if you want, or you can just keep it invested. Now, Blue Owl Capital is tying up the equity of their shareholders. This is like what Michael Burry did in The Big Short. That does not inspire confidence. That does not inspire confidence. This is the kind of thing that makes runs on banks. And so, Blue Owl Capital preventing their shareholders from redeeming their shares. And instead, you know, basically doing bread lines to get your money back. That's alarming. That's alarming. And it has terrible implications for the rest of the United States economy. All right? Because who invests in Blue Owl Capital? Who gives Blue Owl Capital their money? Well, for one, it's banks. Banks give Blue Owl Capital their money. Pensions give Blue Owl Capital their money. Universities give Blue Owl Capital their money. Other private equity firms who get their money from banks and pensions and universities, they also give money to Blue Owl Capital. The money all belongs to someone. And when you had a policy that was that, oh, you can make withdrawals however you want, like this, like this, like this, what do you think the pension funds thought? The pension funds thought that, hey, if I need to begin paying out some of these retirees, I can just take money out from Blue Owl Capital. The banks thought, hey, if some depositors come and withdraw, I can take out some money from Blue Owl Capital. The private credit or the private equity companies who gave money to Blue Owl Capital and said, hey, I can get this amount of money back and then I can pay off the pension funds, I can pay off the universities, and I can pay off the banks that want their money. Well, it's all safe. Like, that's not happening anymore. Now it's rationing. Now there's going to be a tightening on, and what happens in this case is that the worst don't make it. The worst, least, the firms, the lenders, the investors that did the least due diligence, that had the least amount of guardrails, they will be the first to take losses on this. They will be the first to take costs related to this change in liquidity. And that could end up with, say, like a Silicon Valley Bank situation where they don't have the liquidity and people come back. They're like, hey, can I get my money back? No. Oh, well, I'm going to do a run on the bank. And it's, you know, it's not that serious. Blue Owl Capital is just one of the many private credit lenders, but they are one of the major private credit lenders. And just like how First Brands and Tricolor were able to create, what was it, a 9-figure loss for Jefferies because of their sketchy borrowing practices, because of their poor stewardship of their lenders' funds. And they were just some nobody company that ended up being able to rack up such a quantity. There will be, to some extent, maybe not a palpable one to the American consumer, but certainly within the balance sheets and the offices of the investors to Blue Owl Capital, there will be ripples, right? Money's got to be taken from somewhere to offset this. And, you know, now is not the worst of it, certainly. If, you know, data centers ended up being a much poorer investment than these risk analysts at Blue Owl Capital and BlackRock and, you know, other and Oracle modeled out, there could be some bigger costs on the table. It is notable to say that Meta is not largely exposed to this issue. Because of the way that they did their financing arrangement with Blue Owl Capital. It's a little ridiculous. It honestly doesn't even seem fair. It seems like, you know, Meta found the dumbest guy on the stock market and was able to arrange a bunch of funding from them. But there's a big issue here, right? Blue Owl sold about $1.4 billion in its investments across three of its funds already. And they sold it to pension funds, insurance companies, But they're not selling it at 100 cents on the dollar. It's certainly taking losses. And, you know, this is a major issue with private credit that academics raise. And it's that there's an idea that because you don't have depositors, because all of your funding is coming from equity for the most part, or because it is so equity-based, your funding, that there's a bit degree of safety to it. But the question is, who is giving you the equity? If it's a bank giving you the equity, well, now you've just laundered it. You know? A depositor still needs to get their money from somewhere. So, yeah, we'll see how this, you know, private credit as a financial instrument fares through this era of bad behavior and poor credit analysis and poor lending practices. And, you know, I'm not going to mince words. This Blue Owl Capital is a prime example of poor lending practices. Everything about their exposure to Meta's data center build-out and to other hyperscalers' data center build-outs screams stupidity, it screams laziness, it screams greed. And we're going to see how these junk bonds really fare. But, you know, that's not for now. That's not for now to say. But certainly, not something that happens to a company that was doing what they should. On another note, in fixed income, in bonds, lenders, this is from Wall Street Journal, lenders to commercial real estate owners pay up now. The commercial real estate market has taken a hit, has taken a series of hits. It's really like Mike Tyson beating up a nerdy fifth grader and stuffing him in a locker for the rest of his education career. Commercial mortgage-backed securities are doing poorly. All right, there's no two ways around it. The commercial real estate market. Sorry. Yeah. I just got a shout out. Someone just stormed the studio to tell me I was doing a good job. Thank you, Sean. Yes, yes. Yeah, the commercial mortgage-backed securities market. Delinquencies are up fourfold since 2022. And, you know, on its face, this doesn't really make sense. There's an idea that, you know, yes, commercial real estate will be used less, you know, post-COVID. But if the construction of these commercial real estate properties was being done properly, if it was being scaled up at a reasonable pace, we wouldn't have an issue where delinquencies are up fourfold, because the leaseholders, right, would just pay their leases. I mean, the leaseholders are paying their leases. So, you know, it's another example of poor scaling and taking advantage of low interest rates to go and build nonsense that doesn't last. The commercial mortgage-backed security delinquency rate is up to, I believe, 13%. No, 12.5% as of this month, as of last month. Up 12% from about 2%, it's almost sixfold since 2022. It's gone, ever since 2023, it has been steadily climbing. This is about mostly just economic tightening after the post-COVID, rate crunch. And, you know, the rate of delinquencies is alarming, all right? This is the commercial mortgage-backed real estate, or commercial mortgage-backed security delinquency rate is almost on par with that of the student loans delinquency rates, which are around 16%. And that's alarming. You know, when I think of people who can't pay their debt, I think of students, right? I think of English majors that went and they did what they loved, but now they can't get a job. And now they can't pay back their student loans, you know? I don't think of major borrowers who are building up commercial real estate, who are building up skyscrapers in Atlanta, in Charlotte, in Miami, in Fort Lauderdale, in Dallas. I don't think of them. And it's a bit alarming that I have to think of them. And to the same degree that I think of the college population that was lied to with the idea that you can just take out student loans and all will be fine. You'll be able to pay it off the moment you get a job. It's not that easy. Let's be real, guys. All right. Student loans are very difficult to pay off. And you know what? Not to get distracted here, but it baffles me that student loans are one of the very few debts that you cannot escape in your life. You cannot get out of it through bankruptcy. There's no way of getting out of student loans through bankruptcy. The U.S. government, and you know, in a very invasive way, is beginning to garnish wages of people who are delinquent on their student loans. That scares me a little. That scares me a little. And it's garnishment on a large scale. That is the most alarming part. But yes, so commercial real estate is having a hard time. All right, and I feel like we hear that every single day now. I mean, Saks Fifth with their debt going to pennies on the dollar because they expanded at a poor time and they weren't able to recoup the cost and they weren't able to pay back their suppliers and now they're going out of business. Saks Fifth bankruptcy. Saks Off Fifth shut down. And now, you know, the commercial real estate market is potentially having a similar moment. Delinquent loans, you know, the price on those loans does go down. Because when a company goes bankrupt and goes into liquidation, unlike student loans, you just have to take what's given to you as a lender. You can't garnish the shareholders of that company for the rest of their lives. You cannot track them down and email them and harass them and call their parents and call their family members and embarrass them publicly, getting them to pay off their loans. It doesn't work like that. You take an L. You take an L on your loan. You take an L on your lending practices. Close to $25 billion of these CMBS loans are past maturity without being paid off, liquidated, or extended. And they say that is up from virtually none before the pandemic. The pandemic upset everything. And, you know, only part of that is due to a shift to remote work, right? Ultimately, employers learned how to be more efficient with their workspaces by utilizing remote work software and, you know, filling and using hoteling systems with their workspaces to put more people in less office space. But ultimately, this is still an issue about the economic situation tightening. That's what I'm putting out there. But yeah, so, you know, fixed income's having a moment. I still believe that the yield curve is not inverted. Let's see. We might be moving towards an inversion. Let's see the 10-year curve. Oh, goodness. What are we? Oh, wait, no. That's not it. Daily Treasury yield curve rates. Okay, yeah, we're not inverted yet. There is a weird, not backwardation, but so a weird like seasonality where it seems like everyone's scared of what's going to happen in the next 1 to 3 years. But past that, we're definitely not in a in an inverted yield curve, which would typically be the sign of a recession. For those of you who don't know, the yield curve is essentially just like a tracking of yields across treasuries, across maturities of treasuries. So normally, what would happen in a normal yield curve is that as the time goes on for a treasury, so you go from, you know, 3 months to 6 months, year, 3 year, 10 year, 30, the yields will go up because, you know, you can demand a higher interest rate when, you know, as you go into the future, because people won't be as certain as what rate will be worth money then. Right. So you get a little bit of, you get a little bit of a premium on that. And then they all kind of revert as time goes on. But an inverted yield curve would be when rates are lower as time goes on, because people are so terrified of as to what could happen in the future that they don't want to get their durations wrapped up in their portfolio. They don't want to get the Macaulay durations wrapped up in a 30-year, right? Because, you know, liquidity might be tight. And that's basically it. It's just uncertainty about what really will happen to interest rates as time goes on. And so that's a recession indicator. When the yield curve, so it'll go like 3.7, 3.5, 3.25, 3. That would be an indication of recession fears, or, you know, indicator of a recession in itself. Because, you know, those things are quite to a significant extent self-fulfilling prophecies. The fear of a recession brings recession. But yeah, so we don't have that right now. So it's uncertain what really will happen in the bond market currently. We are seeing some weird irregularity in the curve. You can look it up. But no, you know, we're not in inversion. I'm going to do a PSA, because the PSA is a beautiful thing. We have to do a PSA every hour here at Moral Hazard to talk to you about what's really important. And that's getting a designated driver.
When might you be buzzed? When you suddenly love everything.
You guys, I love this song.
I love these nachos.
I love our kickball league. Ugh! I love this guy.
What's your name?
You know what I'd love? A ride when it's time to head out.
If you see a buzzed warning sign, call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
I love your car. Is this real leather?
I love fixed income. I love business news. I love markets. I love Gavin Newsom. I don't. I don't trust a guy with veneers. I don't trust Gavin Newsom. I don't trust any man with veneers. You know, I was looking at the polling results for the Democratic primary, and it broke my heart to see Kamala Harris and Gavin Newsom riding the top of that curve. Because, my God, we're just throwing away the win now, or are we just, you know, is the Overton window shifting? What's going on? Gavin Newsom's more of like an Overton window shifting. Gavin Newsom runs on the platform of a 2010s Democrat and a 2010s Republican, like a Mitt Romney and a Barack Obama merged into one in terms of his policy stances. Yeah, he's an Overton window shifting guy. Kamala, I don't know. Maybe she can win. You know, it might be like a Trump 2024 thing where he's like, I lost against Joe Biden. You saw what he did. Come on, come back over. But we'll see how Kamala does it. I don't know. Maybe I'll go out and I'll Pokemon go to the polls on that one. I don't know. I'm more of a Hillary Rodham Clinton fan. Can she run for president? What happened? How come Hillary Clinton hasn't run for president recently? You know, she had that one thing in 2016, and then she kind of gave up after that one. You know, it's a shame. I mean, you know, Hillary Clinton's emails, nowhere near as bad as the emails that are getting released now. You know, she was just asking for pizza. This stuff is real. I didn't see Sergey Brin in Hillary Clinton's emails. I didn't see, I didn't see Tom McMillan on Hillary Clinton's emails. UMD Board of Regents Tom McMillan. He's a member of the Board of Regents at the University of Maryland. He's not on the Hillary Clinton emails, but he's on some other emails. We're going to move aside from fixed income. I know you guys don't want to hear about bonds and yield curves for the rest of your life. Let's talk about late night TV. All right. You know how much I love Jimmy Kimmel. We're going to talk about someone else tonight. We're going to talk about Stephen Colbert. During his monologue, Stephen Colbert lashed out at the FCC, lashed out at Brendan Carr for their enforcement of the equal time rule. So the equal time rule is an FCC rule. And it means if you give time to a politician running for public office, you need to give time to a politician of the opposite party, and you need to give equal time to the politician of the opposite party. This is to prevent issues like where a scenario where the media only interviews the one they want to win and they don't give any attention to the one they don't want to win, right? That's the FCC rule. Colbert is having problems with the FCC's equal time rules. Who cares? I don't know. So a show motivated by partisan purposes does not get an exception to the equal time rules. The FCC's guidelines for equal time rules, though, only apply to television. They only apply to television. They notably do not apply to radio. As a radio show, you can have whoever you want on, whoever's running for political office, you can have whoever you want on. You don't have to do equal time. And so really what I'm trying to get at here is that if you are running for public office, or if you know someone who's running for public office, bring them on to Moral Hazard. Brendan Carr, me and Brendan Carr are like this. You can't see it, but I'm doing like the little fingers crossed together. We're tight. Me and Brendan Carr are tight. All right? We're like two peas in a pod. If you bring, you can bring whoever you want running for office. I don't care. I'll platform anybody. If you're running for office, I don't care what your platform is. I'll give you a platform. Come here. We only have one working mic, but it's a really good mic. The mic shield. I don't know what you call this thing. It prevents pop. A pop filter. Yeah, we got a pop filter on the mic. You know, we're really getting fancy now. If you're running for the student government, if you're running for Senate, Maryland Senate, if you're running to be a one of the Maryland, you know, county seats, whatever, I don't care. Come on here. I'll give you unequal time because that's my favor to you. You give me political favors once you get elected, or not elected, I guess. I don't know. I'll get political favors from your enemy once you lose the election because you're on Moral Hazard. And you know, there's a complaint. I think it mostly is a Wall Street Journal complaint that the equal time rules applying to television and not to radio prevents an unfair skew towards Republican platforms, because radio is largely a conservative largely conservative medium. There's a lot of conservative radio shows and not a lot of liberal radio shows, leftist radio shows. And to that I say, Wall Street Journal, have you heard of Moral Hazard? Probably, because Moral Hazard is actually a conservative radio show. People don't know this. Here at Moral Hazard, we're like Rush Limbaugh. I went to a satanic temple and I bathed in the blood of children and I was reincarnated with Rush Limbaugh's mentality and Rush Limbaugh's soul. And that's really what's going on here. See, that's a good thing I don't get the equal time rules, because I'd love to platform some Rush Limbaugh type candidates. Someone who believes in what does Rush Limbaugh believe in? I don't know. Killing babies. Or no, wait. Not killing... Let me think. I actually don't know what Rush Limbaugh believes in. I just know he was, like, yelling and smoking cigarettes and whatever. Yeah, Rush Limbaugh, friend of the show. I've been reincarnated with his soul. But yeah, you know, it's good. It's just good that equal time rules apply to everyone but me. You know? I don't have to give... Well, thankfully, I don't have any people running for political office, to my knowledge, on the show. Except for me. Do I have to give equal time to myself? I don't know. The news is talking about the disappearance of Nancy Guthrie. And that is the mother of Savannah Guthrie, who's some news anchor. She's on CNBC. Yeah, she's the co-anchor of the NBC News morning show Today. And her mom's missing. Yeah, I don't...